This program is designed to provide general information with regards to the subject matters covered. This information is given with the understanding that neither the hosts, guests, sponsors, or station are engaged in rendering any specific and personal medical, financial, legal, counseling, professional service, or any advice. You should seek the services of competent professionals before applying or trying any suggested ideas.
Woodbury Reports with your host, Lon Woodbury, talking with leading professionals about how parents and others can help their struggling teens, preteens, and young adults. Now here's your host, Lon Woodbury.
Welcome back to the Woodbury Report. This is Lon Woodbury. I'm located in North Idaho. And here's where we talk with knowledgeable people about all things involved with struggling young people and the schools and programs that try to help them. Today, we're going to talk about the difference between gold, G-O-A-L, digging, as opposed to gold, G-O-L, digging kids. It's a difference between kids that are have gold-oriented and are doing something and entitled kids. And as a guest, we have Sherry Campbell. Good morning or good afternoon now, Sherry. Glad to have you here.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be on your show.
Okay, well, I'm going to be very interested in learning about your book and your practice. Sherry is a PhD, licensed psychologist with 2 decades of clinical training and experience providing counseling and psychotherapy services in Southern California. In her private practice, she currently specializes in psychotherapy with adults and teenagers, including marriage and family therapy, grief counseling, childhood trauma, sexual issues, personality disorders, illness, and more. She has helped individuals manage their highest high and survive the lowest low, from winning the lottery to the death of a child. Now, her interactive sessions are as unique and impactful as her new book, Loving Yourself, The Mastery of Being Your Own Person. We'll talk about the book later on. But, Sherry, this is very, very good. And you have 6 tips to raising a gold-driven child. So let's go through those and talk about them and all the implications for them. The first one, a few ways, and you have a few suggestions, a few ways to show a love connection. What do you mean a love connection and how important is that?
Well, you want to parent your children with attachment. You know, you want your children to feel that you are incredibly attached to them. You see them. You're not judging them. Why are you like this? Why are you doing that? You know, you want to be more into the, it seems like you're not happy today. What's going on? You know, you don't want to come at your child with any kind of a shame-based parenting. And then when you do that with your kids and you treat them as people, not as something that you need to change for yourself, they respond a whole lot better.
You know, you mentioned it with attachment. Talk about that a little bit more, because there's been a lot of press about that, attachment parenting, and it's gotten pretty sophisticated in that. So explain a little bit more. What do you have in an attachment? Why does it attachment get poor, and what can you do to repair it when it's a poor attachment?
Well, children who are provided a sense of well-being from the very beginning of life will spend the rest of their lives striving to keep that feeling. So when you value your child emotionally and you give them security and lots of touch, eye contact, and patience, your children become motivated to repair their own sense of well-being when they lose it, because it's been largely integrated into their sense of self.
So attachment parenting is basically, and I remember hearing somebody that says every kid needs some adult that's crazy about them. It could be a parent, can be a mentor. And so that's what you're talking about. Some adult that's crazy about the kid knows it, and they have the feelings of being attached and loved and cared for. Am I in the right track?
If you value your child emotionally, you're going to get a lot better behavior out of that child. If you are only controlling and managing their behavior, that child is most likely going to feel a sense of shame or guilt that they're not good enough.
Okay, well, let's talk about some ways where it can go wrong. We have a kid that he's narcissistic, or he doesn't, he believes nobody cares for him, puts up a wall, you can't even get through with it. So how would you approach that?
Well, typically those kids, if they end up in therapy, you have to start to teach them the difference between their inner world and the outer world of their behavior. Unfortunately, if a child comes in very narcissistic, they're only centered on their self, and that makes them very difficult to be around. And somewhere in there's a lot of shame. Most emotions have a physical outlet. Like if you're sad, you have the physical manifestation of crying. If you're angry, you have the physical manifestation of being able to yell or shout or do something aggressive. And guilt will motivate a child to change, but shame doesn't move. And so it's very difficult to help a child once they've been incredibly shamed. It takes a lot of patience, and it takes a lot of working hard to get into that child's emotional self and to try and change the child's opinion of who they are. They need a lot of affirmation and a lot of discipline.
What's the difference between shame and guilt?
Shame is something that is about the person, and guilt is about the behavior. So shame teaches the child they as a person are bad. Guilt teaches the child what they did was bad.
Ah, okay. So it's along the lines of, I love you, but I don't like what you did.
Exactly. Yeah. Shame is the worst thing you can do to a child, or even if you're a manager, let's say, of a corporation, you don't want to shame your employees, because it creates learned helplessness in many ways. Like, I am never going to be good enough, so I'm not going to try. Whereas if you use more of a guilt-based approach, like, I'm not sure why you did that. Help me understand what was going on, why you did that certain, thing. And then what could you do differently? Instead of what's wrong with you, you're ridiculous, you're stupid, I can't believe you did that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You've got to focus on respect the inner world of a child. Many parents use language with their children that they have no idea can puncture that child's self-esteem for years to come. So we have to be really careful on respecting the inner world of a child.
Okay, and so you got to watch out to make sure that you're not, you're criticizing the shame sounds like you're criticizing the essence of the child, and they take it to heart.
Yes.
And they conclude, I'm
mm-hmm.
no good. Whereas,
or you're stupid. I can't believe you did that. You know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
That's the languaging that shaming is. Whereas, help me understand what happened.
Okay.
What made you behave in that way? What could you have done differently? Instead of you need to be different, what could you have done differently?
So shame is a negative motivator, almost in all
yes.
cases, whereas guilt mm-hmm. can be a positive motivator to do better next
yeah.
time.
Yeah. Yeah, and you can also use encouragement with guilt, like, I see why you did that now that I understand your thoughts. What could you have done differently? How could you have been even more successful? What behavior could have you have done next? And then that child strives for that betterment in themselves.
What happens if the kid decides, no, I didn't do it wrong? You get off my back.
Well, at that point, then you're not dealing with a kid who is really wanting to move forward in whatever that is. If they feel like they didn't do it wrong, then life will teach them, right? You can say, wow, mm-hmm. I'm surprised that you don't see how that didn't benefit you, So, yeah, I mean, try that one again and see what your results are.
Okay. So it sounds like that takes a step a little bit deeper into what's going on. There's
mm-hmm.
some reason why they're not accepting guilt because, their self-esteem is so low in the toilet. Their ego mm-hmm. wouldn't allow them to admit they made a mistake.
Right. And I think that at that point, that child's already been shamed. If that child is going to come off with a comment like, well, why do I need to change anything? That child has already been living in shame. So once a child is shamed, they become very hypersensitive to any criticism from anyone, and it causes them to have a very difficult time in their relationships because they perceive everything then coming at them as shame, even if it's guilt.
Can someone, I can see how, shame by how you act, but can a kid impose shame on himself by totally misinterpreting what somebody's saying?
Yes, but I would think that the adult around them would see. You know, shame has a certain body language to it. And if an adult sees that a child is feeling shame, excuse me, that adult needs to go in and repair it right away. You know, hey, whatever I said, I wasn't trying to shame you. Help me understand what you're feeling right now.
Okay. What could a parent look for? You mentioned body language and expressions. What did they look for to indicate that the child's feeling shame? What would be some of the manifestations?
Well, the shoulders stoop over, the chin goes down, you lose eye contact, and they become very quiet. That's one way. Or they will automatically have that initial response of the body language stooping over, but then they may get angry and try to fight for themselves, you know. So if you have either of those responses, both of those are coming from a place of fear. You know, anger is always coming from fear. So if a child acts out in anger at you somewhere, they're just trying to fight for who they are. You've got to get below the anger to the hurt and figure out what did you hit? You know, what trigger did you hit? But parents who shame don't typically care that they're shaming, you know, because when you shame a child, sometimes their behavior does turn around, you know, and they can become an overachiever trying to outrun the shame, and others become underachievers. But either way, the overachiever or the underachiever, they're both operating from fear or shame. So parents who use that, because I have parents who shame in my practice, and they do not see the fault in it. Even if their child's cutting, they see that as a problem with the child. They don't see that as having any result of their parenting, which then also makes the parent narcissistic.
Okay, so any of those types of actions or a lot of negative behavior sounds like you can just assume someplace shame got into the mixture and the child is manifesting it. Is that a correct assumption?
Yes, absolutely. Yep.
Okay. Now, one thing I forgot to mention at the beginning of it, if those of you that are listening live on K4HD.com, we have a chat function and in the lower right-hand corner, and if you have questions or comments, you can add those in, and we'll try to get to them. And we have a few questions. We have a listener from Tennessee, and that it's a what if. What if you have a teen girl that is at the stage she is blaming you for everything, she's acting out and really getting out of hand, what should I do?
What I would do is that child is, you know, pushing the limits on the discipline to see how far they can go. And teenage girls are probably the hardest people on the planet to deal with. So I have empathy for this.
I had three daughters. It's not a newsflash to me.
Yeah, I you know, all my cutters in my practice are teenage girls. They're not boys. So I have empathy for her. And I think, too, right now we live in a real you know, gold-digging society where the Kardashians are what we're looking up to for our kids and wanting the clothes, the bags, you know, the purses, whatever. So I'm not sure what she's struggling with particularly, but saying no to a teenage girl is hard because they will push you until you break. But if you break, you reward that behavior. So really, it's about accepting that your teenage girl just really might not like you for a couple years as you say no, being able to stand that. And I often work only with the parent and not the teenager because it's the parent that suffers. You know, like my teenager doesn't like me. If I say no, she's going to hate me and they get afraid of that. It's just temporary. So saying no is much more important because you want to teach your teenage girl that anytime she wants something, that when she gets out of your home, the world is not going to bend on its axis to give her what she wants. So better for the parent to teach her than to have life really run her over because she's going to learn it at some point.
So you got to have boundaries and firmness.
Oh, absolutely. And that is love. Now, the teenager doesn't like it, but the parent has to become unattached to what the teenager likes or doesn't like. They have to see that bigger picture of this is how I need to raise my child to become whole as they enter into the world, right? Because they're going to go to college and a professor is not going to care when you're the, you know, the number 300 in the biology class in the auditorium. The professor isn't going to care if you didn't get an assignment in and you want an excuse for it. You know what I'm saying? So
yeah,
the parent needs to teach those no's right now, no matter how hard it is.
That's one of the reasons parenting is so hard is because these lessons have to be learned then, or it won't be learned very well when you get knocked around by the school of hard knocks.
No, because the school of hard knocks is a lot more painful than not liking your mom for a couple years, you know?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Okay, there's a couple others. You mentioned earlier that when you get to evidence of shame that you talk, what's caused that, and, you know, get to the root of it. Well, what if you can't seem to wrap your head? This is a listener. What if you can't seem to wrap your head around why they did it? How do you work through that? Because sometimes the I can see situations like that. Sometimes they give something, just doesn't make any sense. You know,
teenagers do this all the time because they're trying to learn who they are. You know, so they lie a lot. They do things that you can't even fathom that they would do, but they're really discovering themselves. You know, the prefrontal cortex in the brain shuts down from the ages of 15 to 21. Researchers really don't have any idea why that happens yet, but they become very self-centered at that time. So truly a part of their brain just isn't functioning, and they become self-centered, and that's necessary for development in many ways, right? Because you've got to separate from your parents, because you have to leave the home, go to college, get a job. So 15 to about 21, kids are really experimenting with being independent, making crazy decisions on their own to get tattoos or to pierce themselves or, who knows, do drugs, experiment in other things, because they're trying to figure out who they are. Understanding the why of it isn't always necessary. It's how you discipline it.
Okay,
kids don't even know why they're doing what they're doing.
Yeah,
it because others are doing it.
Yeah, I've heard that many times. Why'd you do that? I don't know. And that's true sometimes. Oh, there's another question that follows somewhat similar. What if you cannot make them see the action was wrong? And I'm thinking that might be helpful to for the parents that are listening. What if you can't make them see the action was wrong?
It isn't going to matter if the child knows that action is wrong or not, because they may not think it is. You still have to discipline a wrong, quote-unquote, behavior the way that you would discipline a behavior. You know what I'm saying? Remember, at this age, these kids aren't thinking about why and how, and they're not putting a lot of thought into their decisions often.
So you're, again, the parent is substituting for the kid's prefrontal cortex until it gets back online.
There you go. What a beautiful way to say that. That was beautiful. Yes, exactly. You're being the prefrontal cortex, you know what I mean, for them. And they don't always need to understand why what they did was wrong. The hardest thing for me in my practice is when a parent, let's say, uses curse words with their children, and then the teenager will curse the parent back, and the parent goes, "You can't talk to me that way." And then the teenager's like, "Well, why is it wrong for me, but it's not wrong for my parent?" And then the parent will say, "Well, because I'm the adult."
Yeah,
that is the worst kind of parenting you can do ever.
Yeah, it's sort of a crazy maker.
Total crazy maker. And then those kids don't understand why what they're doing is wrong.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? They can't understand it because the parent's doing it. And so, that's a situation where no understanding can be had.
Yeah, a good way maybe to look at it is that if something's wrong, the kid just at least needs to know that the parent thinks it's wrong and they don't do it.
Exactly. Yeah, and then the parent can explain why it's wrong, and that's how you coach, you teach, and you mentor your child. They aren't always going to know why what they did was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so that's your opportunity to get in there and love them and show them. You're guiding them through the world. You know, you've already been their age. So you get to kind of guide them through that.
Okay, well, it's a stormy time, especially with a kid that has some of these issues, and that's what we see a lot of in our practice. Well, the second tip that you have, how do parents teach self-worth? And the kids that we've been talking about, well, their self-worth is probably, they haven't found it yet. So how do you teach parents teach self-worth?
I think that parents have to have good self-worth first. And I think a lot of parents really need to think about if they do model positive self-worth to their children or not. You know, if you're a parent who isn't motivated in your own life to take care of yourself physically, emotionally, mentally, or spiritually, you are not going to raise children that are going to do that. You are the model that children has to look up to. So the best way to teach your children to love themselves is for you to love yourself. Right?
So it's very important for the parent to have a pretty firm grasp on themselves. Mm-hmm. So they need to grow up.
parents, yes, I can't even tell you how many parents I need to grow up actually even more so than their children sometimes, you know?
Yes, I've seen that.
Yes, and so if you're extremely obese, you're not going to be raising a child that looks at you and thinks, wow, my parent really takes care of him or herself. If you're smoking, you know what I mean? Your child is going to do what you do, not do what you say. And so that's what I think parents really need to be inspired by. If your children are going to do what you do, much more so than do what you say, let that inspire you to be the best version of you that you can be.
Okay.
And then your children will follow in line with that.
Okay, so the role model part is important. Now, there's another follow-up from the Tennessee listener that asked before. For the teen girl issue, the parents should be tough and stand their ground. Now, she's talking about a specific example. She is on suicide watch right now and is asking to be emancipated. What would you say to these issues? Well, it sounds like it's way out of control.
I mean, that's too much for me, really, to talk about just on the radio, but somewhere the discipline got completely lost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they lost control of the child somewhere, somehow.
Okay.
You know,
so,
and that child is now acting out, you know, in a tremendous amount of pain and or attention seeking to get his or her needs met.
So that's a time for professionals to take over. Parents can't
100%. 100%. I cannot assess that situation on the phone because I just don't have enough information, and I certainly don't want to be in any way offensive or minimizing or blaming toward a parent, but I do think that somewhere the discipline was lost. The child stopped responding, and now you're at this extreme space where the professionals need to get involved and help the parents and the child.
Okay. Well, let's move on to tip number 3. What is the value of using a name? That's a fairly simple thing, but I think very important.
Well, you know, when you use your child's name, you make them feel important. Anytime I give my daughter a chore or a compliment or anything, I always say her name because it's directly related to her value. It lets your child know how special they are. They're a thing in the world. You know, they're just this important little entity in the world. And also when you discipline your child, when you say their name, they take you seriously, but it also softens the discipline a bit because you're not criticizing the person, you're criticizing the behavior. So I think that when you love your children and you God knows how long you planned their name before they were born, you know, use that name in a very loving way always.
Okay, well, that seems to be universal because that's in adult society, use people's names. It really helps, makes a big difference. And the first thought I had when you were talking about, teachers in the situation dealing with the kid using the names.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an experience when I first moved here to North Idaho. Our kids went to a small K-8 school. I thought those were extinct until I got out here. But they've since changed that. The professionals have changed that. But it's K-8. It was under 200 kids. And it was amazing what that school could do. It made me an advocate of small schools because if a kid was acting out or running in the halls, every teacher could say, "Hey, Johnny, stop that," instead of, "Hey, you, stop
right.
that." They That's used
right.
their name because everybody knew everybody else in a small school. That's some of the problems of some of these massive schools we have is that, you know, 1,000 kids or more, is that
That's
nobody
right.
knows their name, most of them.
Now, when you go to college, your professors aren't likely to know your name either.
Mm-hmm.
So as a parent, when you use their name as often as possible, they leave the nest knowing who they are. And so they will want to maintain that feeling of well-being. So as they get out into the world and someone doesn't remember their name, they're not important to a professor, right? They'll already have that embodied.
Mm-hmm.
So I always use my daughter's name as often as I can, because when she leaves that nest, she will know how to make herself important.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a good practical tip and very, very valuable. I know in business, always possible, I know a lot of people, a lot of teachers, first thing they do is learn the names of their students. You know, I'm thinking of high school. And it's for that reason, and the same thing with the parents. Okay, item number 4, tip number 4, are rewards important?
Yes, rewards are so important. You know, this is where behavior-based discipline works instead of shaming-based discipline. There's no rewards with shame, right? Mm-hmm. You do what you have to do for a parent to get them to stop shaming you. And that's the motivation on shame-based parenting. But rewards carry over. So as your child gets older, you want to make sure that you encourage and compliment all of their talents and interests. Because as you celebrate them that they're doing something well, they get a major feeling of gratification that does carry over, and it helps them to be more open to try new things and to achieve new things. So I always look at rewards as the beginning of the development of the internal motivation that creates self-starter, which is what we want. We want our kids to be self-starting.
Didn't that sentiment get twisted in the self-esteem movement? Like everybody gets an award for showing up, and they don't keep score of the games and things like that that we've been hearing about.
Well, that turned into entitlement, where the kid didn't even have to work for the reward, right? That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is there's a behavior that's done, like good grades. That child should get a dinner out, a reward, something personal.
So a reward has to be tied to something that's real, a real accomplishment.
It has to be tied to an achievement, yes. Then your child will learn that happiness is a byproduct of achieving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if my child isn't doing well in school or whatever, I don't give her things. You know, I'm not going to go buy her an iPhone. What I see in my office is, you know, these kids have iPhones and they have all Fs. And I go, how did you get an iPhone? Or they've got a car and they're not doing well in school, or they've lied. You know, there's got to be... and then the parents can't figure out why these kids aren't more motivated. They have everything they want. Why are they not motivated? Well, because they have everything they want without earning it.
Yeah. So rewards are important.
It has no value.
But the rewards have to be tied to something real. You know, as you say, an accomplishment. And then it's very important. Now, if they do something accomplished and nobody and the parents don't give a darn, that's a negative, right?
Oh, definitely, because then what's the motivation?
Mm-hmm.
Here I did all this work, and I got on the honor roll. Maybe no one from my family's ever been on the honor roll, and so it's no big deal for them. And so what is the motivation? You know, kids want to see their parents be proud of them. Kids want to please their parents. Believe it or not, many parents of teenagers will go, no, they don't. Yes, they do. But they need the discipline, you know, to get there. And it's hard because they're trying to become independent too, and there's a lot of friction in the teenage years, but stay strong in your discipline and stay simple in it. You know, discipline doesn't need to be really complex. I mean, there's good behavior and bad behavior, period. You discipline around it and you explain why. Then that kid will motivate themselves to do better so they can have more of the freedoms or the car back or the phone back, things like that.
Okay, yeah, I think one point here is that discipline and punishment are entirely different things. One's shame-based and the other is reward-based, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because I run into that in the punishment. Sometimes the punishment is you're bad, or you were bad, or you're whatever. But punishment can get really distorted. But discipline, that's teaching. You're doing something for a reason, for teach a particular lesson.
Yeah, I mean, it's really no different than what a coach would do for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was an Olympic hopeful ice skater, and I spent, you know, time at the Olympic Training Center. And, you know, if every time I fell, I was told I was bad or I didn't have the talent, I would never want to skate again. But I was often told, wow, you were almost there. You know what I mean? Try this. Do that. You almost had it. And that just made me hungry. I just wanted to get it. And then when I would get it, and I would, let's say, land a triple, I was rewarded incredibly, whether it's just with hugs and people cheering, you know what I'm saying? Whatever it was, it doesn't always have to be material. I mean, the best reward you give a kid is your excitement about them.
Yeah. No, a kid needs somebody who's crazy about them. We have one more question, then we'll have to take a break. But follows up, how will they really know if it is reward for what they do well?
You verbalize it to them.
Very specific.
Very specific. You verbalize it. Listen, we're going to take you out to dinner. You brought your grades up from C's to B's. We are so proud of this accomplishment. We're taking you out. And then when you go out, do something special. You know, my daughter got all A's and two B's, and she goes to a very difficult school. And so they sent her home with a reward that said more A's than B's. And so I took her out to dinner. She's 10. And I got her a little candle on a cupcake. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. The other thing I did is I printed off the report card and I wrote, "You are a star," and I put it on the door. I don't need her to have all A's. She has all A's and two B's. But it motivates her to get all A's if that's what she chooses and what her goals are, which they are, when I reward it and I put it up publicly because I'm so proud.
Okay.
So verbalize it.
Well, we have to take a break for an important announcement. This is Lon Woodbury with the Woodbury Report, talking with Dr. Sherry Campbell about goal setting rather than gold digging. And we'll come back in about 1 minute about Saving Teens, and it's a cooperative organization to try to help financially stressed families get the help for their kids that they need.
Saving Teens in Crisis Collaborative is a nonprofit organization that was formed in April of 2004 when parents of struggling teens realized that the help they were able to access for their child would prove to be prohibitively expensive for other struggling families. Saving Teens' mission is to assist troubled teens and their families struggling with substance abuse and other emotional issues. We work with the therapeutic program industry to fund and support families with financial limitations as they complete the comprehensive program that they desperately need but may not be able to afford. In partnership with programs, educational consultants, and the family, Saving Teens establishes a payment plan for services that include scholarship, family contribution, and Saving Teens funds. Our goal is to provide a total solution to troubled teens and their families with a methodology that incorporates financial and emotional support throughout a 12 to 24 month process of evaluation, intervention, and education. To donate or to get more information, please visit us at our website, www.savingteens.org. Thank you.
Well, welcome back. This is Lon Woodbury with the Woodbury Report, and we've been talking with Dr. Sherry Campbell about gold digging. Or gold digging. If you've been following the conversation, it'll be clear. So, Sherry has a book, and she has six tips that we're working from, six tips for raising a goal-driven child. So, number five, is quitting okay or not? Could you explain a little bit of the background of what you mean by that?
You know what, I think that if your child gives something a go, if you start something, let's say you're going to put them in soccer, and it's an 8-week session, I think they have to finish that out, okay? But If after 8 weeks they do not want to do soccer, they have figured out they do not like it, let them stop. Then go get involved in something else. But I think it takes a while for us to figure out what our kids like. They're still trying everything. It's still new to them. We might want them to play soccer, but they might not want to play soccer. You know, I think it's important to let your child be the true expression of who they are, not who you want them to be. So let's say you grew up playing soccer, and so you want your child to play, but it's just not his or her thing. They would rather do art, you know, than if they really don't like soccer and you force this on them, then you're not seeing them for who they are. It's a fine line. I mean, I think if you start something with a child, you need to make sure that they finish it out. I don't think it's healthy to let a kid quit in the middle of something. Teach them to follow through and to tolerate the uncomfortable. And then when it's done, if it was just miserable, I don't think you need to make your kid go back. But then they need to try, you know, what else would they like to do, you know, and let them discover themselves.
Okay, yeah, and a good point, and they're trying to figure it out themselves. I'm thinking of a granddaughter. She was in dance. She decided she didn't want to dance. She was tired of it, and so they told her, you have to finish the year, but then next year you don't have to. Well, she tried something else, and you missed dance, and so she couldn't wait to get back into dance because she figured out she really did like it. But it comes down to it, just what you're saying. Helps them figure out what they are and what they want.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, okay. And I think it's important.
Okay, so what happens if a child, if it's allow them to quit?
What happens if what?
If a child doesn't finish something, they allow them to quit. They say, I don't like this, I don't want to go. Okay. The parents say, okay. So what happens with that? What's the implications of allowing them to quit too easily?
Well, what happens is then they get lazy. And they never find the ability to tolerate the uncomfortable. I mean, think about it as an adult. How much do we have to tolerate the uncomfortable? A lot. Whether it's financial or friendships, we get older, you know, people are getting, you know, we're in our 40s, 50s, 60s, whatever, people are starting to get ill or whatever, or we lose our job or we're not happy in our marriage. We have to learn to tolerate the uncomfortable. If every time your child quits when they don't like something, one, they become spoiled, two, they become entitled, and three, they never learn patience and they never learn to tolerate the uncomfortable. They begin to feel like they don't need to change, the world needs to change, and the world isn't going to change.
You know,
so that child has to learn to function in a world where it's not going to be his or her way all the time.
And some of the consequences, I was thinking of the marriage statistics, and so many times as people go into marriage with high hopes, and as soon as things get a little tough, when it's going to, they're too quick to pull the pin. And that sounds like they had some parents that didn't, that allowed them to quit too easy. And with devastation for the child, because again, the kids are the ones that are most hurt by divorce. And if the divorce is because the parents, it just got tough and they didn't want to do it anymore. Isn't that a very good reason? Then the kids are getting the wrong lessons, and everything's coming back negative, coming down on them.
Now, if parents quit easily, so will their kids. You know, again, we are their greatest teachers, their greatest role models. If we are not emotionally healthy, our children are not likely to be emotionally healthy. If we are not mature and we cannot tolerate the uncomfortable, neither will our children. If we come home from work every day complaining that life is this way and that way, our children will learn to see the world through those eyes and they will complain. So I think the greatest work in being a parent is that it should inspire you to be the best version of you that you would want your kids to be. And so if you're quitting as a parent or complaining and everything's negative or you're yelling and throwing tantrums, guess what? So are your kids. They're going to do the same thing.
Right. Sometimes it's really scary to see my kids running around and imitating me sometimes, particularly if it's something that I did in one of my weaker moments.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, one of my points, too, in parenting is that you have to teach your kids to be human. You know, I mean, no one can be happy all the time. And sometimes life is just really hard. And a parent's unhappiness can transfer over to their child, right? Because the children look to their parents as a mirror for their emotions. But if as a parent you're having a really rough time in your life, you're going through a divorce, let's say, you are struggling with breast cancer or you've just lost your job, be honest with your children so that they can learn that emotions are natural and that life is full of ups and downs, but let them know you're strong and you've got it handled. Right? I mean, you've got to be real with your kids. If you're really struggling and you get out there and you're trying to fake it, but they hear you crying in the bathroom, they learn that emotions are bad and they need to go hide in the bathroom to get rid of them. You know, there is value in being able to cry in front of your child and say, look, life is hard for mommy or daddy right now, but this is just sadness. It's a natural emotion. I'm fine. You don't need to fix me or take care of me. It's just sad. You know, when you got sad on the playground the other day because so-and-so took your ball and how sad you were, I'm just feeling sad, but I'm strong and I've got it handled. You know, be real with your kids because they need to learn to be human. You know, we are created with emotions because we are supposed to feel them. And I think that there's a very adult, mature way to feel your emotions in front of a child if there's a crisis.
Okay, let's go on to the sixth one. This, in some ways, it seems like it's a summary of all the preceding ones. How can I teach responsibilities? That's a big one, and I'm sure you got some very practical advice for the parents listening.
Well, I feel that you should give your children jobs. You know, chores around the home, responsibilities. I mean, one of the main ways children develop self-love or motivation, confidence, or values is through helping to maintain the family life, the family home, you know, running errands. If you've got a child that drives and they can drive others, then you can give them the responsibility of driving your other siblings, their younger siblings to school or running to the grocery store. But there should always be household chores. And I do a reward system with my daughter on her chores. And when she gets those done, she gets a certain amount of money every month I give her the money in cash, and she has to pick out her present for herself or whatever she chooses, and I make her pay for it. And she keeps the change, and whatever change is left over, then she gets to add to her little pile, and then we continue to build things up that way. But I think that when you give your children household duties, it helps them to experience their worth, and it provides them with a sense of accomplishment, reward, and a belonging to a team. You know, there's a lot of self-centeredness going on right now in our teenagers, more so than before, and I hardly have one teenager that has any chores. And if they do, they just complain about it, and they don't want to do it, you know, and the parents have lost some of the control on that level, and so then we start to take rewards, or they get privileges taken away because they have to learn to work in a group. I mean, when you get out into the world, let's say you're in corporate America, you better learn to work in a group because you're going to be in a group. Mm-hmm. So it's really important to give your kids responsibilities.
And I think that can happen at a very, very early age, because I know at 2 or 3, the kids are really anxious to be helped.
Oh,
just
yes.
180 degrees different from a typical, stereotypical teenager.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And also understand that teenagers are the hardest children, people in the world to discipline. So be gentle on yourself, but don't let up. You know, don't let up on the discipline, but, you know, it can be scary to discipline a child because they'll yell at you, "I hate you," you know.
And that's very scary to some parents. Especially
Yeah,
especially if they haven't grown up very well.
Yep, teenagers know the parents that will be scared of that, and they work them. And so that's where the parent, I think, needs to enter into some therapy and increase their own self-esteem. So,
okay.
I mean, go ahead.
Yeah, well, we have a comment from one of our listeners. The world is not easy. That's what we've been talking about. And things don't go our way all the time, but we should always try to get the things to go our way. So shouldn't we be straightforward from the start about things the way they are? Previous comment, but is that sugarcoating life? Should we not be truthful about things? And they say you should be truthful. Well, I think that's sort of what you're saying.
Yeah, I'm thinking that you should absolutely be straightforward and truthful with your kids. I mean, what does it serve your child to not know that the reality of life is that it's ebb and flow? You know, that beautiful saying, "This too shall pass," we always use in our painful times. But if we pass into a painful time, that means a time of increase also passed. So that too will pass. Your times of increase and favor will pass, just as your painful times will pass. You know, it's ebb and flow. And the more that your child is prepared for that, the less when a good time comes will they clomp onto that out of fear, like, "Oh my God, this can't end. I won't be okay." You know, our painful times probably teach us the most on resilience and hard work and how to keep going, how to tolerate the uncomfortable. I don't ever think you should sugarcoat your life to your child. You know, because there's realities of life that are challenging. I don't think you need to scare them. I mean, you'd be careful with the languaging you use, but use the words such as challenge. I always tell my daughter, anytime that you're in a challenge, that means that opportunity is right around the corner. Keep pressing forward.
You say something very interesting here in the material you sent me. You know, giving children household duties, which is part of what you're talking about, helps them experience their worth and provides them a sense of accomplishment and reward. And all of that could fit in just by letting them do the work. I was thinking it can get all distorted, particularly in our modern times. But I have a grandson. He was 12 or 13. And a couple of years ago, he was in my place, and I had him help me a little bit. It was very minuscular, and it got too hard. He didn't do very much. But I tried to say, well, you know, I was talking to him last month and on the phone, and I said, "Well, you know, you helped a little bit with that." "Yeah, and you never paid me either." Well,
That's why I always say the best reward for a child is the excitement that the parent shows them in their eyes and their emotions.
Well, there's a long story behind this, but that was something I think, oh, good grief. You got to pay.
No, I get it.
and he was living there at the time, and that's part of being part of the family is doing your share.
That's right.
He didn't do that. And that was Well, that's a long story on that.
Hard about that?
Yeah.
Let me just finish a point here. What's hard about that is that technology makes things for this generation a lot different than ours, okay? Because our children experience change 4 times faster than we do, and they can have things that they want immediately. So they can go online, shop, click it's in the bag. You know what I'm saying? Or if they don't want to be alone, they have Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. These kids aren't learning patience, and that largely is due to technology. So when he says, wow, well, you didn't pay me very much, you know, you can say, yeah, because this really wasn't about payment. This was about just helping and being a part of the family, and I can't tell you how good it made me feel that you participated.
Well, I was
trying to say that verbal.
If I was going to pay him at $10 an hour, he earned about 10 cents.
There you go. Well, then you should give him that feedback.
Yeah.
And that's honest feedback, you know?
Yeah, well, he wasn't hearing it. But that's something, and I get that an awful lot. How much are you going to pay me? Pay. And,
right.
I think there's a lot of things. Well, you have something here that you sent, a little life message. You say children need to know that hard work is their way to success. They learn that to achieve their goals, responsibilities come first and leisure comes second. I like that. You want to elaborate a little bit more on that? Because I don't think all that many kids are really that soaked in.
Yeah, you know, I think that leisure right now, and this is due to a lot of the parenting, but the number one babysitter these days is the internet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for kids, it's iPads, it's all this distraction, and these kids are learning laziness. And it's not laziness we learned because we didn't have all this technology. But, you know, emotional and mental health is synonymous with maturity and or responsibility. So the way that I run my household and the way I encourage parents in my practice to run their household is responsibilities come first and then leisure. So when they get home, schoolwork needs to be done, chores need to be done, and all those things. And then the rest of the night, if they've got the time without homework, is up to them what they want to do, right? Mm-hmm. But I don't promote letting kids choose when to do their homework. You know, often it won't get done because they get lost on Skype or Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, whatever their social media is, and they get caught up in that. There's a lot of bullying that goes on there and subtweeting and all this stuff that you know, I'm still getting used to myself. But I like to see that my daughter gets her responsibilities done first and foremost, and then she's truly free. You know, I don't like procrastination, and I don't want her to learn that, and so I just teach it, and it just is what it is. I've been raising her that way since she was little, so she doesn't know there's another option. So it just is what it is. You get your stuff done, and then you go out and play.
And it feels so much better when you can do that.
Well, it does, because you don't have responsibilities nagging at you like, oh, God, I got to do my math homework. You know, she's free. Her free time is truly free. And so, and it also just teaches her something good.
All right, we have about 3-4 minutes left, and I wanted to give you a chance. I guess you could call it a commercial break, but you have a book, Loving Yourself, The Mastery of Being Your Own Person. Why don't you talk about that, a little bit about your practice, and how people, if they want to ask you questions, how they can get a hold of you.
Yeah, well, you can get a hold of me through my website, and that's www.sherricampbellphd.com, and Sherry is S-H-E-R-R-I-E. And I have a huge Facebook following. I have like 60,000 fans, and I do therapy every day on that page. I blog something therapeutic every day, twice a day, and it's really powerful for the people, and it can kind of keep you soothed, you know, and you can contact me personally through there or my website. My book is sort of a memoir in the beginning of me having some faulty parenting, and I was a pretty out-of-control teen. And it kind of describes how I learned to get myself together, who helped me, how that help went. And it just sort of shows that journey. And then the rest of it is sort of self-help, learning how to set boundaries as a parent or a child. You know, sometimes children need to set boundaries on their parents if there's abuse there. So, you know, there's all of those messages in there. The book's doing very well. It's been out for about a year, and it teaches you as an adult, if you didn't have good parenting, how to love yourself anyway. And so that's not a book you're going to want your kids to read. So read it for yourself. Learn to love yourself and to become who you really want to be. I was able to do it. And it's really sort of a do-it-yourself therapy book. So if you can't afford therapy, this book is really phenomenal in terms of helping you step-by-step through the process of learning to detox your past and make yourself a better future.
I think that punctuates something you said earlier. In order to do the best job of raising your kid, take care of yourself.
Absolutely. Yes. Love yourself. You deserve it.
Okay, well, we've about run out of time. This is Lon Woodbury with the Woodbury Report, and we've been having a conversation with Dr. Sherry Campbell, and we've been talking about raising gold digging, or G-O-A-L digging, rather than gold, G-O-L-D, digging kids. Responsibilities versus, say, entitlement on that. And Sherry, thank you very much. This has been really great to have you here, and we could go on for forever, I think. I think we could, yes.
No, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure. I hope everyone got something out of it.
I hope so, too, and maybe we'll have you back again sometime on that.
I would love it.
Talk a little bit about your book. Okay, well, this is Lon Woodbury with the Woodbury Report, and be sure to come back next Tuesday as we have a series of interviews with people like Sherry that are knowledgeable in working with kids.